in order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart I take refuge in the three jewels, in order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart I take refuge in the three jewels, in order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Wow, good evening. Welcome. Nice to see everyone. So first, a little logistical discussion. Thank you all so much, very much, so much for your generosity. Overwhelming, amazing generosity. Thank you so much for that. And thank you all for your perseverance, making it to the end here, continuing on. That's awesome. So our question is, should we take a break next week and then continue the week after and go till, like, I think I just worked out that we could do the next sections in seven classes, taking us to July 2nd, just before July 4th, and then take a break for the summer. What do folks think about that? Or do you want to end before July and keep going next week?
What about the week of profound treasury? You going to take that off?
No, we're going to keep going. Yeah, how many people go into the profound treasury retreat? One, two. We'll have to record for you. Yeah.
Actually, it's 7 o'clock. I could just pull out my phone like I do here, and because we're not doing anything at 7, are we? Yeah, not really.
That's true. Probably not.
Hmm.
Okay. I think that sounded like a week off, and then continue. Right. Okay. Cool. And in the next, so let's see, a little more logistics tonight. I was thinking, the reading in the book has two sections. One is other systems. What's it called? Analyzing other systems. And then the last section is establishing our own system.
Yes. Maybe we should skip the one and just go to the second.
I was about to suggest that. Number one was exceedingly confusing, wasn't it? At the least, we could start with number two. And then I thought, start with presenting our own system and then go to the text that I circulated by John Gokongshul that has such a nice, clear, simple. I see Sue is in favor of that. Any other votes, thoughts?
Okay, I thought it was just me that was confused. I wasn't sure, like, does he mean this is positive or negative? Kept, like, switching back and forth.
The differences are so subtle, oh my God.
But yeah, and then reading the additional reading kind of clarified some of that. And I was like, God, oh, he meant that was weird.
Yeah, so let's do that. And then I thought in the first class of the next segment. Oh, Eric.
I didn't get the control, I think, because I started the class late. I might not be able to. If you can send it to me now, or maybe you'll put it on the screen, but either way is fine.
Yeah, I'll do both. Anyone else not have
appreciate
it handy? I will put it on the screen, but anyone else need it?
Is that the one you sent May 1st? I think. What?
Let's see. Yes, May 1st.
Okay.
I was looking at that my email on the screen. Did anyone else want me to forward it to them? All good. Okay, and the first class of next segment, maybe we can look at, if people would be interested, we could look at Trumper and Bechet's presentation and sort of see how that compares to the presentation of Shamatha Vipassana that we read through in this text. That's always fun to do, right? It's a little hard to do it in one class, but we can give it a try, see. In particular, it's the Vipassana that's quite different, obviously. Okay, so let's start off on page 103, which for those of us that are using the digital format, it's in the segment called, we're in the chapter called Removing Doubts. And certainly the first part of that did not clearly remove all doubts. So removing doubts about how to sustain meditation on the view. And I guess we're in part D. The explanation that removes the explanations that remove doubts concerning the actual view, which has two parts, other systems and our own. So part two of that, page 103. Okay. We can understand our own system from the previous explanations in the Vipassana section on identifying the view and the ways to sustain it, which I think will is sort of repeated and clarified in the additional reading by Jomgun Kongchol, and from the scriptures and reasonings presented throughout this section on removing doubts. Nevertheless, I will discuss it a little bit more now, since it is taught that the direct realization of the true view of emptiness occurs when the bhumi of the noble ones is attained. At this juncture, I will present the view that is within the sphere of experience of ordinary beings. Thank you so much, Tashi Nam-gyel. For the rest of us, anyone venture a guess what is the bhumi of the noble ones is attained? So how many bhumis are there? There's 10 bhumis, right?
11
bhumis, or 13. Yeah, there's different schemes. So the bhumi of the noble ones.
Is that the first one?
The first one, yeah, the first bhumi. So the first bhumi is equivalent to the path of seeing, which is where one becomes a noble being, an arya. Thank you, Cynthia. And one sees, one experiences, or realizes non-conceptually, directly, emptiness, the true nature of reality. The most important thing is to discover the view of emptiness, regardless of how we do that, whether it be by using analytical meditation or through resting meditation. Interesting that you can do it either of those two ways, both of which were presented above. The sutras teach that no matter how good our view and meditation are, if they lack that view of emptiness, we will not be able to sever the roots of cyclic existence, which is why it's said that Vipassana is essential and that Shamatha is not sufficient. Accordingly, the commentary in Bodhicitta, a text by Nagarjuna, says, those who don't know emptiness are not receptive vehicles for liberation. Those confused beings will circle in the prison of existence as one of the six kinds of beings. We all know the six realms. It is absolutely not acceptable for us not to discover the unerring view. It's pretty firm, strong, command. As Naropa's summary of the view explains. So Naropa's summary of the view is a famous Mahamudra text, and it's in a book by Trungpa Rinpoche called Naropa, Masters of Wisdom, or something like that. The Wisdom of Naropa. When the view is not mistaken, meditation and conduct are in harmony with things, and awakening is attained. So we have view, meditation, and conduct. So if the view is not mistaken, then the meditation and conduct follow. It is like a horse who has been shown the racetrack. If the view does not accord with things, meditation and conduct will be confused, and no result will be achieved. It's like a blind person without a guide. When seeking the view, it is not enough to end up with simply an intellectual understanding of it through relying on the prajna arising from listening and reflecting. So we got two schemes going on here. We have the three prajnas of listening, reflecting, and meditating. And then we have three stages of accomplishment, let's say, that start with intellectual understanding, and then experience, and then realization. And experiences are temporary. Experiences come and go. We have like flashes of experiencing bliss, luminosity, non-thought, things like that. Those are the main experiences that one encounters on the path of shamatha, in particular, as that progresses. And those terms, bliss, luminosity, and non-thought, are sort of the fruitional level of those. And they begin with just well-being, clarity, insight. You know, the bliss starts with well-being, joy in the practice, like the sort of feeling of not being barraged by thoughts constantly that at some point or sometimes we enjoy. Luminosity begins with clarity, insight into this and that, like the things like Rinpoche's version of the portable stage set, or what realm we're in, or habitual patterns, or past experiences, things like that. And then non-thought begins with little gaps, little just like periods where it feels like nothing much is happening. So he's saying that the understanding arises from the first two prajnas. And the implication then would be that experiences and realization arise from the third prajna, meditation, where we bring together shamatha and vipassana. So in listening and reflecting, vipassana is cultivated separately from shamatha. It is essential that we experience and know the view right within our own mind by relying primarily on the prajna arising from meditation, the third type. So we actually experience it in meditation. And he uses that term, experience and know. And know is not like quite realize, but maybe it is. I'm not sure if that would be an alternative translation for realization, but certainly experience, the second of the triad of understanding, experience, and realization. The sutras, secret mantra, and esoteric instructions all teach that the culmination of the meditative process is achieved by observing the mind. The Guhya Samaja. So the Guhya Samaja is the sort of root tantra of the later traditions of Buddhism in Tibet. In particular, the Gelugpa tradition uses that as its root tantra. And for the Kagyus, the Heivajra Tantra is generally the root tantra. So the Guhyamaja is a sort of standard tantra. When you examine your mind, all phenomena reside within your mind. These phenomena reside in the Vajra of space. They are neither phenomena nor dharmata. Although he just called them phenomena, he's saying they're not phenomena. The Vajra of space is such an eloquent Vajrayana way of referring to sort of the ultimate nature of mind. And just a reminder that at this point in this tradition of Buddhism in general, as in particular Vajrayana Buddhism, the nature of reality becomes focused on the nature of the mind. We're not really talking about the nature of rocks and trees and things like that, or skandhas and ayatanas. We're talking about the mind, since the mind is the source of everything. The Vajrapanjara, which is a commentary on, I guess, the Guhya Samaja, I think, proclaims, inspired by the precious mind and meditating on mind itself, there is Buddhahood. The Descent into Lanka Sutra teaches, and this is a famous little scheme here, relying on mind alone, you do not conceive of outer reference. So that's stage one. Resting within thusness, with thusness as your object, you transcend mind alone as well. So that's stage two. So resting with thusness as your object. So once you've determined that all objects are thusness, the whole experience of subject and object dissolves because there's no perception of anything. So there's the idea of a perceiver dissolves. Once you transcend mind alone by that dissolving process, go beyond the absence of appearances. So initially, by dissolving mind as the result of dissolving the object of mind, there's like a gap experience of absence of appearance. And we have to transcend that because it has a conceptual framework of there being the concept of the absence of appearances. Yogins and yoginis who abide in the absence of appearances see the Mahayana. Go beyond the absence of appearances. Who abide in the absence of appearances see the Mahayana. That's a little tricky, huh? Well, that fourth stage doesn't quite seem different than the third one. We'll have to investigate that. The ornament for the Mahayana Sutras by Maitreya observes away that there is nothing other than mind, step one. Then they then recognize that mind also does not exist, step two. The great Brahman Sarha says, when mind is fettered, you are bound. It can be liberated, have no doubts. In other words, mind is everything. For these reasons, both Kamala Shila's stages of Madhyamaka meditation, which I'm not quite clear what text that is, if that's part of the stages of meditation or a separate text, and Ratnakara Shanti's instructions on Prajnaparamita, which expound the paths of the two great chariot systems. And the two great charioteers are Nagarjuna, the great charioteer of the view, the profound view of emptiness, and Asanga, the great charioteer of the vast activity of the Bodhisattva. And those are sort of stock phrases. The first one is fairly clear, Nagarjuna, the profound view of emptiness, and Asanga, the vast activity of the Bodhisattva, is a phrase that includes the detailed explication of the stages of the path, all the different aspects of the path. For these reasons, both Kamala Shila and Ratnakara Shanti would expound the paths of the two great chariot systems, expand the meaning of what is taught in the Descent into Lanka Sutra, and explain the yogas of focusing on the mind alone, part one, by letting go of the idea of externals, focusing on thusness, letting go of mind, and then focusing on the absence of appearances. Thus all texts on the stages of meditation, regardless of whether they belong to the sutras, secret mantra, esoteric instructions, explain that initially, when we are investigating the view, it is impossible not to employ discerning prajna. That must be included. There are many reasons for this, such as what is taught in the final stages of meditation by Kamala Shila. Although all phenomena are already simply empty of any inherent nature, simply meaning like nothing else, that does it. If we lack discernment, if we don't like discern that clearly, we will not realize their emptiness. Nevertheless, when we analyze with discernment, in the end, discernment itself must be pacified and lead into non-conceptuality. The Sutra of the Questions of Kashyapa states, Kashyapa, it is like this. For example, when fire arises, when wind causes two trees to rub together, once fire appears, it consumes those two trees. Similarly, Kashyapa, when there is discernment of what is true, the Noble One's faculty of prajna arises. Once that arises, it will consume the discernment of what is true. So there's no more sort of active process of subject and object in the form of discerner and discernment of what is true, or truth as the object and discernment of it as the subject. The middle section of the stages of meditation by Kamashila teaches, the Buddha taught that when the fire of understanding what is true just as it is arises from discernment of what is true, the wood of conceptuality is consumed, just like the fire produced from rubbing kindling consumes the kindling itself. Analysis is not confined to examination and analysis involving terms and their reference. It is also necessary to analyze during meditative equipoise. The sutras say, when you rest evenly, you know what is true just as it is. So as you're resting, you're knowing, interestingly. And that statement, it's also necessary to analyze during meditative equipoise is very interesting, given what we saw last week about, and in the section that I skipped, that we skipped, about those others, like Tsongkhapa, and the predilection for continually the analysis during meditation. So it's sort of interesting to see Tashi Namgyal say that. Let's see where it goes from that. The first stage is a meditation teaches, once you have stabilized your mind on an object of meditation with shamatha, if you examine with prajna, the light of true wisdom will manifest. That's implying that if you don't examine, then it won't arise or manifest. Through analysis, discernments, which are the analyzer, are pacified in and of themselves and become a non-conceptual state that has no essence at all. So this process of analyzing during meditative process is like the kindling, starting the fire. You need it at first, but then it needs to burn itself out. This is the actual view in this context. So that's the view that we need analytical process in Vipassana initially until it burns itself out, and then we rest in that understanding or ideally experience or hopefully at some point realization of emptiness. A sutra states, the absence of seeing phenomena is true seeing. So that experience of not seeing, not conceptually identifying, is the true seeing. The first stage is, as it is said, when what does seeing the ultimate mean? It is the absence of seeing any phenomena. At this point, the mind, free from dullness and agitation, which are the two main obstacles to shamatha and vipassana, does not conceive of anything and does not grasp at anything. Free from mindfulness and attention involving percepts and perceiver, mind rests free from elaborations. And from the section we skipped, this statement, mind, the first part of this little section, the mind free from dullness or agitation does not conceive of anything and does not grasp anything at anything, includes the idea of emptiness or the understanding of emptiness or any sense of the actuality of emptiness as an object must not be conceived of and must not be grasped at. It's said in a sutra in Dharmata, just as it is, so rests mind that is just like it, meaning Dharmata, experience unhindered by words, meaning by verbal conceptuality, the level of labeling, all labeling that goes on constantly in the conceptual mind. So experience unhindered by that dawns, and that is called samadhi. Atisha, the exalted Lord, teaches in the Dharmadhatu, free from elaborations, rest your mind, free from elaborations. Let mind merge with Dharmata by having mind go along that progress of analyzing to the point where there's no object to analyze and no analyzer. And then mind merges with Dharmadhatu. He also says, the Dharmadhatu is without center or end. It is seen by the sharp eyes of the intellect, free from concepts, not blurred by dullness or agitation. Interestingly, it's seen by the sharp eyes. So it like talks about it as a sort of subject-object situation a little bit. So it's somewhat unclear whether that's literal or not. Atisha's instructions on Madhyamaka, which is a wonderful short text on the stages of Vipassana meditation. Well, actually, it starts with Shamatha briefly, and then gives a wonderful explanation of the stages of Vipassana, which we have most of here. What we're missing is the ending, where he talks about how to rise from meditation. But many of us have seen this text a number of times in a translation by Carl Brunholzl. The past mind has ceased and disappeared. The future mind has not arisen or appeared, and the present mind is very hard to examine. If you analyze and investigate what can be shown through reasonings, i.e. that the present mind has no color or shape, that like space, it does not exist, that it is neither singular nor plurality, that it does not arise, or that it is naturally luminous, you will realize it does not exist. That's an interesting list there, right? So he's not at the stage at this point of working with outer objects, but focused on the mind as the source of all. And he is focusing on mind by using the logic of the past, present, and future, the three times. And then the present mind, if you analyze and investigate what can be shown through reasonings, that the present mind has no color or shape, that like space, it does not exist. So the first color and shape is the main initial exercise in all Mahamudra traditions, is looking to see the color and shape of one's mind, which we'll get into when we get into that section, but it's an interesting practice. That like space, it does not exist. So space is the sort of ultimate analogy for something that we talk about, but that doesn't have any objective existence. And mind is like that. We talk about it as if it has some objective existence, but it doesn't. It's just like space. It actually has no entity-ness to it. It's neither one nor many. So he's going through these Madhyamaka reasonings. It does not arise. So the Madhyamaka reasonings were one or many, causation are two of the major reasonings of the Madhyamaka system, or that it is naturally luminous. And that one is very interesting, and this translation differs from Brunholzl's. I should have brought Brunholzl's translation. I'll have to do that next time. You will realize that it does not exist, that it is naturally luminous. That is a very interesting statement.
So, yeah, so you're your perception, your experience, outer experience is luminous, but you're saying not, but not your mind. It's just the experience
that it
becomes luminous.
I think the sense of this is that it is naturally unobstructive, clear.
Yeah, it seems like he's talking about clarity there. Can I make a comment on this paragraph? It's kind of interesting in that first, it's some of these things, he's talking about it from an analytic point of view, it seems, because he says, if you analyze and investigate what can be shown through reasonings. So he's talking about these as reasonings, but it's interesting that and I guess that's because it's in the context of Madhyamaka, because in the context of Mahamudra, you would look at these things experientially, not through reasoning, many of them. And so that is kind of an interesting twist. And also it struck me that whereas he says that the present mind is very hard to examine, but if you read, let's say even like Trungpa Rinpoche, for example, when he's talking about how we approach in Mahamudra, he talks about that actually it's easy to look at mind because it's right there, and that the reason why in Mahamudra we use the mind rather than looking at phenomena is that it's a direct experience.
Thank you for mentioning that. That's a fascinating subject, is that these are very contradictory statements. And yeah, there's a whole thing here that's sort of weird. One, that what you just said is that we all know, there's many places where we're told you all experience your mind directly all the time. You know your mind. You know whether your mind is like relaxed or agitated or this or that or full of emotions or whatever's going on in your mind. You know very clearly. And then we're told, well, you can't know mind. And so they're clearly talking about mind in two different ways. You know, one of them is talking about the mind, the aspects of relative mind, and the other is talking about the entityness of mind. But I wish they would acknowledge that. And then the other thing that's weird is like color and shape. The first thing you learn in like the Abhidharma tradition or the classification of objects, objects of knowledge, objects of subjects, is that there's matter and mind. And mind is non-material, which means no color and shape. So it's like, why would you be surprised that mind has no color and shape? When that's the sort of most basic thing.
So, I have a question also, because in progressive stages of meditation on emptiness, you do get to the last part, which does sort of talk about luminosity.
Oh, yeah.
It seemed like, so, but it's not observable or knowable. Is that what?
It's not really clear. The statement naturally luminous, it has different meanings in different traditions. And so like at the last chapter of the Progressive Stages of Meditation on Emptiness by Kenpo's main student, Shenpen Hukum, is the Zhentong chapter. And in the Zhentong, the focus is on the luminous quality of mind. Whereas the Rongtong chapter before that focuses on the empty quality of mind. There's some ways of interpreting naturally luminous as being that the natural part implies the empty aspect of mind. And the luminous part is the aspect of mind that is like Dharmadhatu, or like Dharmakaya, more like possessing the qualities of omniscience, of Buddhahood. But that gets very complicated and very we can't really go there because we know the author. So it's like we got to stay within this author system. And the teacher was very much a Prasangika Madhyamaka teacher who would not have meant to be talking about Zhentong point of view. So I don't know. Let's footnote these three things that I think we've identified, like color and shape, mind being unfindable but yet easy to, you know, completely available to us, and then this statement by Atisha that it's naturally luminous. And that one, we got to look at Brunholz's translation, and we got to ask Elizabeth. So if we look at the bottom, by the way, there's a little asterisk. So in the next paragraph, right? If both those two, that is material and non-material entities, in the bottom it says, this section of this text, Instructions on Madhyamaka, describes how to examine the two kinds of entities, material and non-material. Moonbeams only quotes the second part on how to examine the non-material, that is mind. So this author, Tashi Namgyal, has skipped the part of Atisha's text where he dispenses with the reality of external objects, of the material, of material objects. Sorry, not external objects. It's similar to the division of external or percepts and perceivers, but not identical. But he skips that part in his quote for some reason. If both those two material and non-material entities are things that have no essence at all and are simply non-existent, discerning prajna also does not exist. The subject dissolves. An analogy is fire, the fire that arises from every two steps. So this same analogy from this Sutra of Kashyapa is used over and over again. The fire that consumed them will go out on its own. Similarly, when Prajna has proven that all phenomena, both specifically characterized and generally characterized, do not exist. So specifically characterized phenomena are dharmas. Dharmas that have characteristics, that possess their own nature, that make them what they are. They are not space. Space is an example of a generally characterized phenomenon. An idea of like time or space or any idea of a collection is a generally characterized phenomenon. All concepts are generally characterized phenomena. All non-conceptual entities are specifically characterized phenomena. So things like anger, desire, memory, mindfulness, earth, water, fire, air, all of those are specifically characterized phenomena. And generally characterized phenomena are things like chairs, tables, anything that's a collection. Now, chairs and tables consist of specifically characterized phenomena. They consist of the earth element and the water element and the fire element and so forth. But their congregation, their coming together by a conceptual process of calling it a chair, as opposed to the molecules in the space around that chair, which are wind, like creating some artificial division of the chair from the space around it. That's a generally characterized phenomena.
But isn't the, for example, the specific chair that you are sitting on or that I am sitting on or any one of us might be sitting on, isn't each one of those a specifically characterized phenomena?
Yeah, so there's two, it's like there's two levels of generally characterized phenomena. One is if we say chairs.
The grouping.
Yeah. Or the chair, to call the thing that you're sitting on a chair is that chair that you name it is a generally characterized phenomenon. You know, the fact that we use a vibration caused by Cynthia's larynx and received by our auditory consciousness, that triggers an idea of what we're sitting on. All of that is a generally characterized phenomena. But the molecules, or the, let's see, the particles that make up the thing that you're sitting on are specifically characterized phenomena.
So I'm confused because maybe I have misunderstood this, but it was my understanding that not only the molecules, because that seems to be putting it down at a particle level as if particles were more real, but isn't the actual substance that you're sitting on, the thing, considered a specifically characterized phenomena, that one chair? Specific, like if you point to a specific blue vase that we're all looking at, is that not a specifically characterized phenomena in itself?
I think the idea is that when you point to a blue vase, or when you point to the phenomena that you are, that it's propping yourself up against the force of gravity, that all that is a collection of particles.
So you don't think of the Husky calendar behind you as a specifically characterized phenomena?
Well, that's this middle level. So I'm saying, like, there's two levels of generally characterized phenomena. There's a concept of calendars, and then I think, and clearly what you're getting at is that usually we say, as a way of contra distinction from the concept of calendar, we say that's a specifically characterized phenomena. And what I'm trying to say is that that's a simplification. That when I point to this, we all think of the whole of that as a whole, and the idea of that as a whole, as a unit is completely generally characterized.
Well, I mean, clearly the whole notion of entities at all is a questionable thing. But I thought that I guess I maybe I have misunderstood that. I thought that when we look at a specific item like that, we can think of it as a specifically characterized phenomena, even knowing that it's made up of parts.
I think what they're doing, that really the specifically characterized phenomena are dharmas. And so dharmas are on your chart of dharmas, and under matter there's the great elements, and then those are the fundamental matter, and then there's derivative matter. And so they're talking about the particles that make up that. All the particles here are specifically characterized, as are the particles on the wall that it hangs on, and my hand are particles that's pointing to it, and the space around it is filled with particles, wind particles.
So essentially, you're saying only the elemental aspect you're saying is considered a specifically characterized phenomenon?
That's what I'm
Okay,
saying.
I guess I'll have to revisit that because that's not my
Sorry.
understanding.
So in relation to the six investigations, that's a different topic.
This is
That's a
one of the
different,
topics. It's one of
in one of
the
the topics.
investigation of things is specifically and generally
And
characterized.
so this is what it's saying when you're looking at that, because I was really looking at it more as like it could even change. Like today I was working on a jigsaw puzzle, and so first you're getting everything that's green, and it doesn't matter what its shape is or anything like that. And so at that point everything is that, you know. But then when you would look at it closer, then you would start seeing different aspects of it. So but anyways, this is very interesting.
Well, I think you got to look at what system specifically and generally characterized phenomena is a relevant, is a term used within, which is the Sautrantika system. And Sautrantika still hold that there are partless particles, but there's no space between them.
Derek?
Yes.
So in another way of using the term specifically characterized phenomena, could you say it's like, I thought it was just direct perception without any concept at all. Like pure perception.
The phenomena, specifically characterized phenomena, are the object of direct perception. That's one way of characterizing it.
Okay.
Right. So when our senses see something, our senses don't see calendars and chairs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our eyes see color and shape. If I remember the material elements, it's the four great ones: earth, water, fire, air, and then the derivative are the objects of the senses. And when you read the Abhidharma, when they talk about how atoms come together, those of us that have been through those courses, and there's like seven or eight particles that make up one like real particle, and there's an earth particle, a water particle, a wind particle, a fire particle, and a sound particle, and a smell particle, and a sight particle, you know, some bizarre way of bringing those all together. But those are the objects of our senses. And so that's more sort of what I'm getting at with specifically characterized, where our specifically characterized, our eyes perceive directly without concept, direct valid cognition, and the object of the eye is not a calendar, not a chair.
Yeah. Thank right. you.
We use that as an easy example to differentiate initially for students, specifically characterized from generally characterized. We say there's chairs as a group, and then there's the chair that you actually sit on. But so I think that's a simplification.
Are we looking at the color and shape level? Because that you said that stuff about the seven particles of this and that.
Even that's unclear, right? Because it's like our eyes don't see partless particles, which are the eight, the collection
right,
of eight.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That is not my direct experience yet.
We see conglomerations of particles.
That's what we think of as color and shape. And that sort of thing, that sort of basic.
Well, it's unclear. The Sautrantikas did not clarify that.
Okay. You know,
so at that point, the whole classification of specifically characterized sort of falls apart, because where do the object of eye consciousness and subtle particles meet? Where do those two sets of phenomena meet? Because we don't see subtle particles. All we see is conglomerations, and are conglomerations specifically characterized? So it's a little vague, you know. So as Anya said, one way that it's referred to is it's the object of direct valid cognition, which is the objects of the senses. And then it's a little vague, like the object.
But even that is like, what is the true object of the senses? So it's quite unclear. I get it.
Which is basically any system, any aspect of any of those Buddhist philosophical systems, when you really drill into it, falls apart until you get to the Madhyamaka system, which says that there's no system that won't fall apart. You know, so then it's like, why is he using that term at all? Right? Why, you know, so at this point, it becomes like a helpful scheme to direct our understanding to concept and beyond concept, simply, I think.
The question is, how helpful is it? I guess it's almost becomes more unhelpful at this point.
Yeah.
When you're walking on quicksand, it doesn't help that much, you know, which is kind of where you are here.
Yeah. So let's see one more time. He says, similarly, when Prajna has proven that all phenomena, both specifically characterized and generally characterized, do not exist. You know, so we have a Prasangika Madhyamaka saying, you know, everything, even specifically characterized, it's sort of like as well as the generally characterized sort of goes without saying, does not exist to the Sautrantikas, but they sort of believe in specifically characterized phenomena, but here we're saying both don't really exist.
And of course, I didn't mean by any means to take away from the fact that the key point here really is this next part, which is the fact that Prajna disappears. And, you know, that's really what the emphasis of this whole chapter is about, is this sort of melting of discernment, melting away of discernment into the non-conceptual.
Yeah, thank you for coming back to that. Yeah, so that was a large excursus or whatever it's called, excursion. But yeah, and the most interesting part is that Prajna disappears and its luminosity, is luminosity, which was referred to above, that is naturally luminous, which has no essence at all. So it's really cool that we have a Tisha referring to luminosity. You know, so which also means that luminosity, we tend to think of luminosity as like third turning, Buddha nature, you know, Shen Tong, but, you know, it's there throughout Buddhism. From Theravada Buddhism, you have the luminous nature of mind in the sutras the Buddha talks about. They don't, like, pick up on it and make a big deal about it, oddly. But, and the luminosity has no essence at all, anyway. Thus, everything that could be a flaw, such as all the stuff that we've been talking about, which, when you drill into it, makes no sense, such as dullness and agitation also. All of what we went through were like examples of agitation in some way. It's cleared away.
I was surprised, actually, that because it seems like, you know, he keeps coming back to dullness and agitation, but yet it seems like there's a lot more to clear away than that. You know, all of the conceptual cognitive obscurations seem to be a little beyond. To me, I think of them as not just dullness and agitation.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's almost like you would think he would say superimposition and denial, you know, which comes up in other places. But it's almost like he's equating that with a form of agitation, that superimposition, which is thinking that something exists or is there, and denial, thinking that things don't exist, is just an agitation of mind. But it is odd that, yeah, that he refers to them. Add that to our list of oddities. At this point, mind does not think about anything, including all those oddities. It does not grasp at anything. Mindfulness and attentiveness are cast aside. Ooh. As long as the enemy or thief of characterizing or conceptualizing does not arise, rest mind that way. How long would that be?
Which is interesting, because that whole notion of as long as, meaning there's a limit, and you have to know that limit, which means there still has to be some kind of alertness. You know, it says rest mind that way only this long. So it's funny that they're sort of throwing all that out the window, and yet there's still some little thread of it remaining.
I guess what would happen is when
you're no longer resting, right?
When you're no longer resting that way, then mindfulness and attentiveness would return.
Come back, right?
Yeah.
Is that funny?
I will put that explanation in a way that may be slightly easier to understand. First, when investigating the view, you should understand that all phenomena, percepts and perceivers, is the way that we've been, or they've been summing up everything in a handy way, our mind. Then you should examine and dissect the mind using various rational means, such as investigating the mind. In the three times, which is what, you know, he's explaining Atisha's quote. So first step, everything is mind. Which for them is like an easy step. For us, it's like, what? It's like the hardest step of all. Then you should examine and dissect that mind using various rational means, logical means, such as investigating the mind the three times, applying the reasonings, i.e. Madhyamaka reasonings, that it's neither singular nor plurality, or the Madhyamaka reasoning about arising, ceasing, and abiding, and that it is naturally luminous. To add that to the list of reasonings is such an interesting and odd thing. We got to look further into that. Using that approach, and that's an affirmative statement.
I was just going to say that's the only yes in there. Everything else is no, 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 and that's the only. It is. It's so odd.
Agreed. Using that approach, you will understand that it does not exist innately. So natural luminosity does not exist innately. When you see that percepts and perceivers do not exist as any kind of entities or simply non-existent, the discerning prajna that understands that also does not exist. The analogy is that fire produced from rubbing wood consumes the wood and then goes out itself. In the same way, discerning prajna disappears is luminosity. So something that disappears is automatically luminosity. It does not exist at all. It's sort of like it returns to luminosity, which is like the base state of Dharmata. And does not exist at all. When you discover that type of view, the faults of dullness and agitation are dispelled. At this point, your mind does not think about anything and does not grasp at anything. The mindfulness of the intellect involved with percepts and perceivers and all attentiveness are cast aside. Those are two different things. The intellect, mindfulness of the intellect and all attentiveness. It says unambiguously that as long as the faults of apprehending characteristics or conceptualizing do not arise, you should rest your mind like that. And apprehending characteristics and or conceptuality are pretty much the same thing. I don't know how you would possibly distinguish those, but the stages of meditation, Kamala Shila says, understand that all phenomena lack any nature. The thought, there is no nature at all, is abandoned by correct prajna. With objects which are beyond existing or non-existing, meditate with no reference point in your mind, which is free from existing or not existing. As discussed above, those who assert that sustaining the view should be based on shamatha, along with forceful certainty in an analytical emptiness, certainty in the lack of any nature, or certainty in the absence of self. So those who assert that sustaining the view is shamatha, along with certainty of any of these three types, certainty based on or about analytical emptiness, the lack of nature, the absence of self, those who assert that should contemplate well the meaning of these quotations. Since all such certainties are surpassed. Once they do that, they will find certainty in the view, the true certainty. Moreover, there are many explanations that having discovered the view, we should meditate without conceptuality. The Samadhi Raja Sutra says, the wise who understand conditioned and unconditioned phenomena destroy their discrimination of characteristics. Resting in that absence of characteristics, they always know that phenomena are empty.
So can we say that the view is not
no view.
Seeing emptiness, but resting in emptiness?
Resting
or in emptiness and awareness?
Resting in the experience of having emptied the mind of any ideas of entity or emptiness.
So the view is emptying the mind.
Yeah, the view is going is it, the view is a is the progression of understanding the emptiness of percept, perceiver, and then that
Okay, I
realization.
got it. So, right, it's the process. That's why you keep saying the view, the view, the view. And I was confused, like, you keep saying the view like all the time, but.
No, that's good. So the view is that one should go through that those stages
Okay.
and completely in order to completely understand the true nature, which is beyond there being any phenomena, beyond there being a mind, and they sort of correlate to the different philosophical systems. There's Vaibhashika sound trying to believe that there's percepts, there's phenomena, there's objects, and then the mind only believes that there's no objects, just mind. And then the culmination is the Madhyamaka, which is there's no realization of those two. So they both, let's see, the stage of meditation quotes the Jewel Cloud Sutra, the Ratna Mega Sutra. If they fully investigate the essence of what is understood by the mind, they will know it to be empty. Through such understanding, they enter the yoga of the absence of characteristics. The yoga, the union, which is the absence of all characteristics. The third and final stages of meditation, Kamalashila says, having examined with Vipassana, we recognize the absence of any essence. That is the entrance to the absence of characteristics. And just a little side note is, when we talk about, so how do we achieve liberation? We achieve liberation through going through one of the three doors of liberation, which is what they're called. And it creates this sort of funny imagery of like these doorways and like a game show, door number one, two, and three. But the doors of liberation are emptiness, signlessness, and I mean, it's usually translated as signlessness, but I believe it's the exact same term that's being translated here as characteristiclessness, absence of characteristics. And then the third one is absence of expectation, or the door of liberation of, let's see, emptiness, signlessness, and wish. They're often translated as wishlessness, which is absence of like expecting anything or wanting anything. And then in certain places they describe like, so what are the paths that go up to these doorways? And basically they say that the path to the doorway of emptiness is a sudden path that most, unless only the extraordinary beings can tread on that path and may get to that doorway. It's very sudden, leaping to that experience, and that the pathway to signlessness is the pathway through analysis. The progression of shamatha and vipassana and the analysis of the Madhyamaka system, the various types of analysis or reasonings. And the doorway, the path to the doorway of expectation is like the long journey of the three or immeasurable aeons that it takes to go to complete the path, or really like the two immeasurable aeons that it takes to go from the path of seeing to the path to the stage of a Buddhahood of complete omniscience. So they're basically saying that the main, the most tangible or accessible path for the majority of human beings is the path of signlessness or characteristlessness, which is why that's being described here over and over and over again. The yoga of characterlessness is the one that's most accessible, that has like an actual path with stages and guideposts and instructions. And the other two are much more. The first one is spontaneous, and the third one is like just a wearing out of the habit patterns that we accumulate throughout beginningless samsara after having achieved the path of seeing. The middle stages explains, thus when yogins, yoginis do not take the nature of a thing to be ultimate, having analyzed it with their prajna, they enter non-conceptual samadhi. Kamala Shila's commentary on the dharani of entering non-conceptuality explains that at the end of analysis, we should only rest in non-conceptuality. The lamp for the path of awakening, which is the fundamental first lamrim, graded stages of the path text, and it's by Atisha, teaches, when through scriptures and reasonings you have ascertained the absence of any nature, which is that all phenomena are without arising, you should meditate without any conceptuality. So basically, like, the conclusion is that if you feel that the practice of the stages of shamatha and vipassana are such that one accomplishes shamatha on the basis of that one does analysis, analytical vipassana over and over and over again, endlessly, that would be incorrect according to this tradition. And that if one had the point of view that based on shamatha, one would just not cultivate prajna, not cultivate discernment and analysis, and just try to rest in non-conceptual shamatha, that also would be erroneous. But that the point of view of this tradition is that one needs, upon the basis of shamatha, one needs to then cultivate analytical vipassana that leads to non-analytical vipassana, non-conceptual a letting go of the process of discernment and investigation and analysis. And that completes the explanation of on removing doubts about the view and meditation. Up to this point, I provided what is essential to know about the approach to practicing samadhi as it is taught in the sutras, tantras, and esoteric instructions. And this has been a cursory presentation given in a generalized way, as opposed to What would a more detailed presentation be like? Oh my god. Okay, so let's go to Jamgun Kongchul's text, which many of us have seen many times, and is a wonderful. So, just to give a little preface to this, we have Tashi Namgyal. Our author of the Moonbeams of Mahamudra lives in like the 16th century, I think the 1500s. And Jamgun Kongchul lives in, 1813 to 1899. So the 19th century. So he's a good three some odd hundred years later. And he clearly knows about Moonbeams of Mahamudra, he knows about Tsongkhapa's texts, he's writing his texts as a condensation and summary of all these other texts and from his tradition's point of view. And this text that we're looking at is a very tiny piece in a very huge book called The Treasury of All to Be Known, of Everything to Be Known. In which he goes through in great detail all of what are called the eight practice lineages of Tibetan Buddhism, which is a scheme that some Siddha comes up with, in the 13th century, and sort of says, these are the eight actual authentic, unique traditions that come from India into Tibet. And they're not the four lineages, they're a separate system. And Jamgun Kongchul, along with his two buddies, Jamyong Khyentse Wangpo, Khyentse the Great, and Chokchur Lingpa, the king Tiritun Chokchur Lingpa, they create what is known as the Rime, or unbiased or non-sectarian tradition of trying to then preserve individually these eight practice trends, eight practice lineages, their texts, their transmissions, their practices, their philosophical view, and so forth. And so the bulk of his 10 volumes of, or 10 books of the Treasury of Knowledge are going through those eight practice lineages in terms of space. But the 10 books basically follows like history and then Shila, Samadhi, and Prajna. And in Prajna, he goes through the five topics of the Shaidra system, the Pramana, the Abhidharma, the Madhyamaka, the stages of accomplishment, which the clear realization, ornament of clear realization, and for him, the Vinaya system would have been in the Shila. And in the presentation of meditation, as like an introduction to the meditations as it's done in these eight practice lineages, which then branches off, and in which his goal is not to like show how they're all the same, as is often the case these days, where religious leaders like to, you know, say all religions are the same, and they strive to show that. That was not his goal. His goal is to show how they're different, and they all lead to the same path of Buddhahood, but they all have very different skillful means. And that's the beauty of the Buddha's teachings, is that he had limitless skillful means, because they're limitless beings and they need different avenues of approach. And so again, the sort of introduction to the meditative system has this little section on shamatha vipassana. So you see in the title, I'm going to start screen sharing it. Let's see. So it's from the Treasury of Knowledge, the stages of meditation of shamatha vipassana. It's from chapter 8 of the 10 chapters, I guess, the progressive classification of the training superior samadhi. This is part one, the stages of meditation of shamatha and vipassana, the general basis of all samadhis. So it's presented in that same vein that we've seen Tashi Namgyel presented, that shamatha and vipassana sum up all samadhis, are either shamatha or vipassana. And this version was translated by two students of Kenpo Tsultram Gyamso Rinpoche under his direction or guidance. There's also a version of this text that's in the publication of the Treasury of Knowledge funded by the Tsadra Foundation. And this volume was translated by Richard Barron that has slightly different wording. And I just prefer this one. So we don't have time to go through all of it, so I'm going to do I'm going to sort of focus on what is called the root text, which is here in bold, as well as the titles, the section titles. So we have the root text, and then we have commentary, and I'm going to focus on the root text for most of these sections until we get to the heart of the matter, and then we'll look at both. Prerequisites for Vipassana to rely on a wise person such as the Buddha or Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche or Trungpa Rinpoche or many, many other wise teachers whose teachings we have access to these days, not only through books, but now through the miracle of other modern technologies. And to seek the view by listening extensively and reflecting accordingly, the first two prajnas. So based on these teachings of wise persons, we then do our part. We seek, what is the view? What are these guys, or men and women, what are they pointing to? What are they telling us is the way to actually proceed on this path? It has in here this interesting phrase, just to focus a little bit on this section. It says, so without unmistaken view, it's impossible to give rise to the realization of Vipassana. I think having gone through what we went through in Tarshin Namgyal's presentation, we have a little appreciation for the sort of slipperiness of the view, that it's a subtle sort of middle way between two possibilities of like continuing just do analytical Vipassana forever or just do non-conceptual shamatha Vipassana. If think that you can do that, and the identification of the view is it's a very subtle process and takes quite some time to apply oneself to the different options and stages and so forth. And in doing this, we rely on the definitive rather than the provisional teachings. And so this is a stock phrase that refers to a scheme the Buddha put out in a sutra called the Four Reliances. That's as part of the early, so-called early sutra tradition of Buddhism, where he says, rely on the teachings, not the teacher. So it doesn't matter if your teacher is big or small, or fat or skinny, or lazy or stupid or whatever. It's what teachings does that teacher provide? And then rely on the meaning, not the words. You know, if they use idioms versus like Oxfordian English, that's not crucial. The crucial point is, what is the meaning? And then thirdly, rely on the definitive meaning and not the provisional meaning. So the Dharma is full of different recommendations for how to cultivate Sila, Samadhi, and Prajna. And there's just zillions of different teachings that the Buddha gave and that other teachings give that are specific to situations or individuals or different qualities that one wants to cultivate. And so those are called provisional. They're provisional, meaning that they are provided for a certain situation, a circumstance. And so they're not universally applicable. Definitive teachings are universally applicable, and they go to the ultimate. Provisional teachings are not necessarily going to the ultimate. Often they're intentionally not going to the ultimate. They're talking about earlier stages of the path or other aspects of the path. In particular, the whole area of conduct has endless nuances and details. Definitive meaning, what is the ultimate truth? To rely on the ultimate truth. This is sort of like a chicken and egg thing. It's sort of like, well, how do you rely on the definitive ultimate truth if you don't know what the ultimate truth is because you haven't given rise to the view? And so it's one of those things where you have to continually come back and say, like, okay, I'm trying to develop the definitive view, and I'm doing that by trying to rely on definitive teachings. And so I need to have definitive view in order to identify which teachings are definitive. And that gets, that has a lot of subtlety and differences. Different traditions view different sutras and teachings as definitive and versus provisional. So it's a whole other subject that requires some time of application to understanding those differences. And then the fourth reliance is rely on wisdom and not on consciousness. So consciousness is necessarily a dualistic experience that arises from causes and conditions, and primordial wisdom is the unconditioned. And the object of primordial wisdom, or there is no real, primordial wisdom is that experience that goes beyond subject and object. And rely on that, not on your intellectual understanding. There's the types of Vipassana. So this is a summary of what Tashi Namgyal presented. There's the non-Buddhist contemplation of the peaceful and coarse levels, which relate to the cultivation of the absorption states, the four form absorptions, and then the four formless absorptions. And I keep meaning to share with you a presentation of that progression. I will try to do that during our break week. And then we have the sort of Hinayana, what we would call Hinayana contemplation of the Four Noble Truths and their attributes is the second type of Vipassana. And then there's the third type of Vipassana is the Mahayana, the Paramitayana's contemplation of emptiness. And he doesn't quite present it as a fourth type, but sort of as a subdivision of the Mahayana, which is often how Vajrayana is presented as a nuance of the Mahayana, is that in the Mantrayana, this is taught to be endowed with bliss. The contemplation of emptiness is taught to be endowed with bliss. And that's the skillful means of the Vajrayana, is that the experience of emptiness is cultivated on the basis of the bliss from the yogas of Mahamudra, or the inner yogas of the channels and nadis and bindus and things like that, which sort of leads to this nuance of absence versus luminosity that we were talking about before. The common preparatory stages are similar. So it says, to those of the mundane path. So the mundane path is the path of individuals who want to achieve a better samsara, which means cultivating the absorption states. So the preparatory stages for all of these types of Vipassana are similar to that process of the, there's these seven stages involved in the contemplation of the peaceful and coarse levels. However, those who have entered the Mantrayana and others do not strive for those. So the Vajrayana system does not include the striving for the absorptions. And the commentary, and then we have the classification of Vipassana according to essential nature of the practice. What is the essential nature of the practice? So the word type becomes sort of convoluted here. It's like we have the four types, which were really four levels or yanas, almost like non-yana, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. And now we have four like schemes, and we saw these. The first scheme is the four levels of discriminating, fully discriminating, examining, analyzing. Then there's the three gateways, and then there's the six investigations. The last of which, reasoning, has four types of reasonings. And through these six, discrimination is applied to each and every phenomena from form up to omniscience. So he explains his version, his understanding of these. And since we're almost out of time, I'm going to skip them tonight, and maybe we can come back to that, to them, because he sort of opens them up in a nice way. But there's one section that I'd like to get to. He says the six investigations should be known as three, the meaning, the mode of being, and the varieties. So the meaning is like the goal or the orientation, the direction or purpose. And then we have the mode of being is the ultimate nature, and the varieties is the relative nature. And he's doing that in order to then correlate the six with the four and the three, based on how he's described those above. And he shows how the six can be folded into these three in this section here. The first of these corresponds to the first, and so forth. But he also slips this in. Vipassana can be condensed into preparatory or analytical and actual or unfluctuating. Very important little distinction there, that there's analytical or non-analytical. But he gives them these glosses. Preparatory or analytical, and actual or unfluctuating. Unfluctuating, that's a funny word. So the implication is that analytical Vipassana is the preparatory beginning phase, and then it results in unfluctuating, which is what we saw in Tovchi Namgyel's presentation of how to actually put the view into practice, is first you analyze, and then gradually you let go of analysis and experience the non-conceptual state. And then here he sums them up. Therefore, the three gateways and the six investigations are included in the four Vipassanas. So he sort of concludes that the four Vipassanas are like the main scheme, and the others are sort of variations on that. And then the root verse says Vipassana can also be condensed into what I just talked about, preparatory, analytical, or actual, or non-fluctuating. It's odd. This root verse seems like it should have been up here before the commentary on it, but that's how the translation appears. How do we meditate? What a nice title, a welcome title that is, huh? So the way to meditate is to analyze selflessness by means of superior knowledge, which is a translation of prajna, and then we rest in a state free from mental fabrication. So we analyze and then we rest. Non-conceptual images are the basis for analysis. Non-conceptual images are anything that we experience in shamatha. I asked Trolloc Rinpoche this question once, what are these non-conceptual images? And he was like, that's just anything. It's the idea is that it's things that we haven't analyzed. So in shamatha, we focus on the breath and as our object, and so that would become a non-conceptual image. And we learn that this term non-conceptual is a little bit of a misleading misnomer, because it's not actually non-conceptual, but it's the level of conceptuality is low in shamatha. You're not thinking about the object. And then in Vipassana, you look at the mind of shamatha, right? We've seen that phrase over and over again, that Vipassana meditates on the nature of the mind of shamatha. So we would then look at what's the nature of the breath, or what's the nature of the mind focused on the breath. Having identified the particular object, so whatever that image is, mind or breath, one cuts through misconceptions. And that's you know, what does that mean? One cuts through. How do we do that? That's the process of analysis and investigation and discernment using reasonings and all the fun stuff that we've just been going through. And he talks about not too tight, not too loose. If one has no understanding of selflessness, whatever type of meditation you do will be mistaken. Therefore, you have to establish the view of selflessness. On the other hand, even though one may have an intellectual view, if one doesn't rest within that, suchness will not have been meditated upon, meaning that it won't come to be a realization. It will just be an intellectual understanding. For first, one first analyzes selflessness by means of prajna and then rests within the sphere of complete freedom from mental fabrications. And this method is common to all systems. Analyze the object by means of prajna and then rest. Moreover, according to the Gelugpa tradition, during the actual phase of equipoise, the resting, the mode of apprehending the object is repeatedly brought to mind. And that is that subtle difference between the Gelugpa tradition and the Kagyu tradition that Tashi Namgyel has referred to a few times. The actual meditation. When meditating on shamatha, due to the concentration of mind, many images appear which may or may not be similar to what is found in the external world. That sounds like a complicated thing, but it's actually like when we meditate upon things, we experience our thought world. We experience our mental world, or our emotional world, and these may or may not match the external world. We may like discover that we live in a certain realm, the animal realm or something, in our mind, and that may not correspond to the actual world that we live in. They can't find in the external world. All of these are known as non-analytical images. Many images appear which may or may not be similar. They may be, maybe we're like thinking correctly about the breakfast we had or whatever it is, or maybe we're dreaming of, you know, coming up with like complaints or problems or possibilities, whatever it is. In the practice of Vipassana, such images arise through the force of shamatha. So in Vipassana, we take whatever shamatha leaves us or gets us to by the practice of shamatha, and then those are taken as the basis for what's called individual analysis, looking at things. And I think this phrase really means analysis of individuality as the basis for analyzing the idea of individuality. I think ultimately that's the main thing, is that we're analyzing all of these images or so-called things in terms of how is it that they are individual phenomena? What makes them unitary, distinct? Thus, analysis is not directed towards the outside, since the mind is solely turned inside. And when analyzing these images arising out of samadhi, it's necessary to begin by focusing on each object individually with prajna, discriminating knowledge, since without identifying a particular object, it's not possible to cut through misconceptions regarding its qualities. So we need specific objects to analyze, not like generally characterized objects. We need to analyze what is the chair that we were talking about, like, you know, really like getting very precise about what is this phenomenon or that phenomenon? What is my mind? It becomes the main one in the Vajrayana tradition. But in this tradition scheme, where he's basically focused on the Paramitayana approach or Mahayana, it's the self. We begin by focusing on each object individually. So in what way is the comparison of the self with the skandhas? In what way is the skandha similar to the body? In what way is it different? In what way is it similar or different from feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness? Therefore, one begins by clearly to bringing to mind the object regarding which one wishes to eliminate misconceptions, and proceeds to examine it through perfect discriminating knowledge, thus ascertaining ultimately its lack of inherent existence. Then, grasping the object of samadhi, the non-analytical image, undistractedly, one should realize its being mere appearance, empty of inherent existence. This is a really interesting phrase. Grasping that object of samadhi, and let's say we're meditating on the sense of individuality of the cushion that we're sitting on, or the body that we think we inhabit, or the self that we think we are. We then look at that like in a fixed way, fixated way, undistractedly. And we'd see, by having gone through this process of discriminating knowledge and analyzing it and eliminating misconceptions, we see that it's, when we realize it's being a mere appearance, empty of inherent existence. It has no true reality on its own, and yet its appearance is undeniable. It's a mere appearance. And at that point, samadhi and prajna are unified, being focused on the same object. So we're practicing samadhi, in this case, on the sense of like presence, let's say. I don't know, this part is like a little unclear. Like, are we actually taking a chair for the object, or are we taking the idea of the self as an object? And if the self is the object, would that be the object of samadhi of shamatha? Are we doing shamatha on the self? Samadhi and prajna have the same object of knowledge. Quoting a Sangha's compendium of knowledge, the nature of the percept, the object is understood to be empty like space, and the perceiver, so that's the first step that we've seen, the nature of the perceiver as examined as to origin, abiding, shape, etc., which is reminiscent of Atisha. And then discriminator knowledge. So that's the second stage. Discriminator knowledge itself, the third stage, like a fire produced by rubbing wood, vanishes in the expanse of not finding, the third stage. And then fourthly, one rests free of grasping. And this is very much like the four bodhicitta slogans of Atisha. The ultimate bodhicitta slogans regard all dharmas as dreams, empty like space, analyze the nature of unborn insight, the perceiver, and self-liberate, even the antidote, discriminating knowledge itself vanishes, and then rest in the all of the essence, one rests free of grasping. And because we're over time here, I'm going to skip these for now. When suppleness is attained, so suppleness is the measure of accomplishment of both shamatha and vipassana. And so here we have the vipassana, suppleness. Ah, I just, how did I do that?
They have this new annotation feature. I have run into it too. You have to,
oh my God. And then we have the two conjoins, although there's differences on the method of development. They need to be cultivated together. Namely, shamatha, vipassana, two together, these three are to be practiced in succession, and the main point is non-distraction, always. When practicing meditation with designations, presumably meaning that if initial preparatory phase of vipassana of analysis, the full discrimination of phenomena focuses on the images arising out of shamatha, and that is the union of shamatha and vipassana. When non-conceptual vipassana is attained, when the analysis leads to a non-analytical state, they have become of one essence and are actually unified. This is genuine samadhi by the perfection of which non-abiding nirvana, which is different than the nirvana of the Hinayana system, which is either with outflows or without freedom from both samsara and nirvana, existence and peace, is attained. And I'll skip this for tonight, the categories. So that was a lot. But hopefully that's helpful and informative. And so we'll skip a week next week, and then we'll start with the next version the week after, and see if using Trungpa Rinpoche's presentation we can discern, like, so how do we actually bring all that into a session of practice, right? Into a session of practice. I remember I went to the Natarja Institute of Dzogchen Pulam Rinpoche once many, many years ago and asked Acharya Lama Tenpa Jeltsin, who's the main Acharya teacher there, how does one practice Vipassana? And he said to me, do you mean in a session or over time or over the progression of, I can't remember how he phrased the alternative, but it was like in one session or over time. So we just saw like over like a whole presentation of how Vipassana progresses over time, as well as a little bit on like in a session, but it remains, I think, elusive how actually one does it.
Did he answer your question on either of those options?
It was not, he did. And I can't remember which I chose. I think I chose in a session. And I think he talked about analyzing the sense of self in comparison to the skandhas. Something like that. And he has a text from Natarja Institute. A transcript of some teachings he gave called Analytical Vipassana. Sorry, it's actually called Analytical Meditation. And he does it in there. He goes through these certain exercises, and he has this wonderful way of presenting the practice of looking at the unitary nature of objects, like taking the chair that we were just talking about in front of us and saying, what about that chair makes us think it's a unitary whole? Is that chair telling you it's a unitary whole? It's a unit, it's a unit. Are you telling it that? Where does this idea that it's a unit comes from? And like, try to actually do that in your, in a contemplative framework, you know, like you're sitting on your cushion, you have a table or whatever it is, pick some object in front of you. And, you know, we conceive of like your laptop. It's like, that's one laptop. That's a unit, or a person, or a room, or, you know, all of these things are units. And where does that idea come from? And looking at, like, where does that idea reside? Where does that sense of unitariness reside? Is it in my visual consciousness? Is it in my touch consciousness? You know, where is that? Where does it come from? Where does that idea come from? Where does it reside? Where is it, like, manifesting in my experience? So I don't know. My memory of his response is vague. More like the initial response was sort of not what I expected.
We can do that next weekend, right? We're going to do a practice again.
So that's on May 19th. I changed that because of Mother's Day. I didn't want to conflict with Mother's Day. All sentient beings have a mother, and whether that mother is alive or present or not, many of us do celebrate that. And I didn't want to interrupt that. So May 19th, Sunday. Hope that works for people who are geographically able to come.
I do think that question of in a session or over time is actually a great one. That because it makes sense that obviously you can't do it all in one session. And I think that, I mean, all of, like, if you look at the Mahamudra investigations and how they lay them out across, you know, many, many, many sessions, it seems to be sort of a clue of, you know, how that question is very important.
Yeah. Sunday the 19th will be hybrid. Thank you for asking that, Debbie. Yeah, we'll still do hybrid as well. I shouldn't have said those who are geographically able to come. That's right. Those who are chronologically able to come, or calendar-wise, if you believe in calendars.
There's even more logistically. At least three of us can't come until...
Yeah, we'll contemplate on your lateness until you arrive.
We have a superior excuse.
You do have a very good excuse, as excuses go. There's a few folks who are doing the preparatory class for the Triana intensive program happening at Madrala Mountain Center this summer. So, thank you, everyone, very much for your perseverance and attention and interest and generosity and all of those in other ways. Let's conclude with the dedication. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings, by the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom, may the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled, may all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Be well.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Good night.